This is the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Hi, hello, welcome to the 30th episode of the Urban Astronomer Podcast. Amazingly, we've been going for more than a year now. I think the first episode came out in February last year, and if I'm honest, I was never entirely sure how long it would last, but here we are, and while the production schedule has slowed quite a bit since then, I see no reason to stop and am still full of energy to keep on blasting forward. This week's episode features the second part of our supernova story, inspired by listener requests to present more serious science and physics explainers. Last time, we looked at the formation of a stellar nursery, so today, we look inside that nursery at the birth of a new star. For fans of the interviews with people who have some connection to astronomy in South Africa, the next episode will see a return to that format. Although our guest has no connection that I can find to South Africa, he is an ambassador for one of the more exciting NASA missions out there, and I think it's interesting enough. I'm going to bend the rules a little. Now, a few months back, I announced a giveaway in which one of you could win a copy of Neville Young's book, Astronomy Within Reach. It turns out that listeners of the Urban Astronomer podcast are a small, exclusive crowd, and not many of you wrote in to say that you would like to win a copy. Well, your loss, but I am pleased to announce that I was finally able to select a winner, and his name is Dave Rees. Dave is from Cape Town, and I just yesterday had his book couriered to his door, so we should have received it by the time you're listening to this. Congratulations, Dave. If you are kicking yourself for not responding, never fear. I have more books to give away, and you'll have plenty of chances to get them in future. Now, I have an announcement to make. Some of you might know that in between the day job and doing all things urban astronomer, I'm also the director of the astrophotography / imaging section of the Astronomical Society of South Africa. Well, I should say was, because I resigned that position a short while ago in order to accept a nomination as director of the citizen science section. Now, this is a brand new section, which I'm basically putting together from scratch, and that's slightly terrifying for me. It's definitely pulling me way out of my comfort zone. But anyway, this is one of my jobs now, and so you're going to be hearing a lot about it in future. If you know of a citizen science project, especially one related to space science or astronomy, and especially if you're part of a team running a citizen science project, I would love to hear from you. I need to hear from you. So please drop me a mail at podcast@urban-astronomer.com and tell me all about it. Anyway, that's the last of the announcements, so let's get started with the feature. Last episode, we looked at how molecules can bounce around in a given space, giving rise to pressure and temperature. We then took a huge step back and looked at a vast cloud of gas made from molecules like this, a gas cloud thousands of times bigger than our solar system. The cloud suffered an internal conflict between the gravity of its own mass, trying to compress it down towards a point at the center of mass, and the pressure caused by the temperature of all its busy little molecules trying to push outwards. If we go back to the kinetic particle model, then it's really just a bunch of molecules all whizzing around trying to go in a straight line, but being constantly impeded by bumping into their neighbors, or being inexorably slowed and eventually dragged back by gravity. When we left, our cloud had, through whatever external shockwaves or internal turbulence, formed a dense knot of gas which had a high enough local gravity that it was pulling in nearby gas a little bit harder than the other parts of the cloud. And as the gas fell in, the knot got larger and more densely compacted, and so its gravity grew even stronger, pulling in ever larger quantities of gas from ever further distances. And although this was an incredibly slow process, taking millions of years, it was also still technically a runaway chain reaction, because the more gas that fell in, the more massive it got, which means more gravity, which means higher compression and density. More and more gas falls in, faster and faster, and this knot of gas starts getting hotter and thicker. After a while, the pressure at the center is high enough that the gas molecules are being pressed right into each other with no room to move. And they now sit close enough to each other that their positively charged nuclei and negatively charged electron shells can begin to interact with each other. The molecules start sticking weakly to each other, and even though the temperature is high enough that they want to immediately rip apart from each other, the pressure forces them right back, and we find that our gas has become a dense, hot liquid. Meanwhile, further out in the cloud, gas continues to pour in, and with it, dust. Dust is everywhere, and it's made from all sorts of stuff created in the outer shells of dying stars and in the heart of supernova explosions. Because dust is everywhere, it too is falling into this region. being harder and heavier, it isn't as easily deflected as little gas molecules. So it makes its way to the center of the cloud, and as it accumulates, it forms a solid core of, well, whatever the dust is made from. Now, there's no guarantee that this process will carry on forever. There might be another larger core forming nearby, sucking in all this, all of the nearby gas and dust. There might be another larger core forming nearby, sucking in all of the nearby gas and dust, starving our core of more material. In this case, the flow dries up and we are left with a big spherical mass, a solid core, a liquid shell, and some gas maybe. With no more material falling in, the temperature stops rising and even begins to fall as the heat slowly radiates away. Some of the gas from the edges, not held on very strongly, might just drift off again, and some outside influence, like the wind of subatomic particles from a star, slowly erodes away the rest. The liquids might hold together if the gas pressure falls slowly enough, and it could even freeze as the temperature continues to drop. If there was a lot of dust, the solid core might be large and substantial, or it might be tiny. Whatever. The point is, this process has stopped and we now have a planet, or something similar at any rate, like a minor planet or a brown dwarf or an asteroid or comet or whatever. But if it does not run out of stuff, if the gas and dust keep coming, well, then our core gets larger and larger and larger. And as we've already said, more mass means more weight pressing down inwards, more pressure, which in turn means more heat. Soon the temperature is high enough that the molecules start to break down and ionize. Atoms get knocked apart from each other and lose their electrons, and now we have the fourth phase of matter, plasma. So now we have a soup of naked atomic nuclei and their electrons swarming furiously around each other. Molecules are electrically neutral, so they behave sort of kind of like billiard balls, only interacting with each other when they touch. But protons and electrons have strong charges, and now that they are not bound to each other, cancelling each other's electrical fields out, they can actively repel them, themselves. They really, really don't want to touch. Have you ever played with two strong magnets and tried to press their north poles together? Remember how it seemed like it was going to be easy, but somehow they always managed to deflect and slip past each other, no matter how hard you try to force them together? Yeah, same thing with protons. So yet again, we are standing back and watching this core, this hot, massive clump of gas continuing to grow, getting hotter and more massive all the time. There's nothing stopping the gas from piling on, so it piles on, and piles on, and piles on. So let's fast forward a few more million years. Now this gas is definitely hot. It is radiating heat away, and while it's still pretty dark, we can see clouds like this from Earth with infrared telescopes. And when we study these clouds, we find hundreds of little clumps scattered throughout, each one of them a core like what we've been describing. So let's go back to this core. After all this time, the temperature has now exceeded a temperature of 10 million degrees Celsius, and suddenly the protons are touching each other. Now, it doesn't matter how hard they repel each other, the density of the gas is high enough that they've got nowhere to go, and the temperature is high enough, their individual kinetic energies, their speeds are high enough, that sometimes they smash right into each other. And when that happens, nuclear fusion begins. Now you're going to have to bear with me, because this is where things start to get a bit hairy. Nuclear reactions are not something that make a lot of intuitive sense, or at least not to me they don't. So far, everything has basically followed the sorts of common sense physics that we all grow up experiencing in daily life. Gravity makes sense to us because we all know that things fall. Conservation of momentum makes sense because we've all bumped into people or kicked a ball and experienced for ourselves how the energy transfers between objects and causes them to rebound off each other. We might not know the fancy physicist words for these things or be able to do the advanced calculus to, you know, work out precisely on paper how it's all going to play out, but we can kick a ball or hit a punch bag or accidentally drop a glass bottle and have a pretty good idea what's going to happen next. But nuclear physics is not like that. Nobody's ever touched a single atom with their hands. Nobody's ever watched a neutron decay into a proton and an electron with their own eyes. This stuff isn't obvious. And although I can give analogies to help you make some sort of sense of it the way I've done so far, they're not going to really convey what's actually going on. So let's just hang on to a few basics that do make sense and try to work from there. Energy is always preserved. It cannot be created, it cannot be destroyed. It can be moved, it can be converted into another form, and as it happens, one of those forms is matter. Thank you, Albert Einstein, for figuring that one out. If it can be moved, That means you can take energy away from a system like our gas cloud and put it somewhere else, so that our little system ends up with less energy, but the energy itself is still around. So when nuclear reactions happen and particles seem to appear and disappear, just remember that the energy remains constant every time. The energy, whether it's in the form of photons or heavy particles or light particles, at the start of the reaction always adds up to exactly the same as what you have at the end. So, okay, we just saw two protons bash into each other. For a brief interval, they stick to each other. But this is not a stable situation. The repulsive force between them is so high that they almost immediately fly apart again. But sometimes, before this happens, one of the protons breaks. It converts into a neutron, a positron, and a neutrino. Now, a positron, before you ask, is an antimatter electron, basically a sort of mirror universe version of an electron, identical in every way except for the fact that where electrons have negative charge, positrons are positive. Think of it this way. The repulsive force between the two positive charges on the two protons is so high that the charge itself gets knocked off in the form of a positron, leaving a neutron behind, and the neutrino, a spectacularly lightweight particle that is extremely small and neutral and doesn't really react with anything, is emitted as well, just to keep the energy accounts balanced. What goes in must be the same amount as what comes out, remember. Oh, and by the way, if you are preparing for a physics exam, please do not repeat what I just said about the positive charge being knocked off in the form of a positron. Your professor will mark it wrong, because it is wrong, but if you're like me and you need a mental crutch that matches common sense experiences to hold strange ideas in your head, well, then it'll do just fine. Just remember, it's a metaphor, it's an analogy, a little white lie that helps you to feel like you know what's going on. Anyway, now we have a proton stuck to a neutron, and this configuration, it turns out, is stable. We also have a neutrino, which flew off into space, slicing through all those pressured molecules like they're not even there, because that's what neutrinos do. And we have a single positron of antimatter floating around. Except that it's not just sitting there, it's flying away from the proton because like charges repel each other. On the flip side, it is also very strongly attracted to any negative charges, and there are plenty of those around in the form of electrons. So almost immediately, our positron finds an electron and they fly towards each other and they touch and annihilate immediately. Because that's what happens when matter meets antimatter. Of course, conservation of energy, so there is something that comes out of that reaction, two photons, which in everyday common sense experience terms mean just heat energy. Except that where the word heat makes it sound like some sort of warm glow, which comes from low energy infrared photons, these are super high energy gamma ray photons, so maybe less heat energy and more deadly radiation energy, but to a physicist it's all the same thing, so back to the story. We've now got our proton-neutron pair, our two high-energy photons and a neutrino. The neutrino flies off, never to be seen again, carrying a tiny bit of energy with it, and our two photons fly off as well, carrying rather a lot of energy, and we're left with a proton-neutron pair, which have, bound between them, less energy than we had had initially when the two protons collided. This is a stable situation and will remain unchanged for a very long time. You see, protons repel each other so hard that even under the crazy, dense, hot conditions we've described, an individual proton might go as long as a billion years before being forced into one of these uncomfortable encounters. And even then, they'll almost certainly just bounce off each other again, with neither doing the whole decay into neutron thing we just talked about. It's an astonishingly rare and weird thing to happen. But there is so much gas, so many protons. I mean, it's not millions, it's not billions or trillions or quadrillions, it's some other kind of billions that probably doesn't even have a name. It's a lot. There are so many that even though a single proton might go billions of years without ever experiencing that fate, it still happens all the time. You know how we talk about being struck by lightning or winning the lottery as being these crazy out there events? Yet people get struck and people win every week. Because the numbers are just so big. So this proton-proton reaction is both super rare and starts happening all the time. So we start accumulating these proton-neutron pairs, which, by the way, are called deuterium nuclei. You've heard of deuterium? Well, it's hydrogen, but with more neutrons in it, and it exists naturally, and in fact a small percentage of all hydrogen in the universe is actually deuterium. It's chemically identical, but it's heavier. And in the heart of a protostar, which is what we can now safely call our clump of hot seething gas, now that fusion reactions have begun, deuterium is being made, and those deuterium nuclei are starting to accumulate. And sooner or later, one of these deuterium nuclei will collide with a proton. In fact, this is almost certainly going to happen because the presence of a neutron makes it a lot heavier than a single proton, and it also makes the whole thing a lot bigger. Protons don't have to get as close to collide so that the repulsive force never gets as strong, and all that extra mass means there's a stronger force behind the collision to defeat the repulsion. If a single proton has to wait a billion years to collide with another proton, a deuterium nucleus only has to wait about 4 seconds. What a difference that neutron makes. So, when a proton barrels into a deuterium nucleus, that's another different nuclear reaction. One proton and one proton-neutron pair collide, and they stick together. One photon comes out, and we now have an even bigger nucleus, two protons and a neutron. Now, an atom with two protons is no longer called hydrogen, it's helium. Although it's a lighter form than what we normally find in nature. This helium nucleus has three subatomic particles, so we call it helium-3. The helium we normally find in nature has four particles, two protons, two neutrons, and we call it helium-4. So, now, where we previously had three protons with a whole lot of kinetic energy, we now have a single nucleus made up of two protons and a neutron, a neutrino that's long gone by now, and three very high-energy photons. Under these conditions, a bunch of extra reactions can happen quite quickly as well, with various different collisions happening between different combinations of helium-3 nuclei, deuterium nuclei, and individual protons. Some of these reactions result in unstable heavy nuclei that then break down again, but the end result to all of them is the helium-4 that we are so familiar with. So we now have nuclear fusion, which is producing an awful lot of very high-energy photons, which can't go far before colliding with other particles and giving up their energy. Okay, so what does this mean for our cloud? Because up until now, we had this balancing act going on where the two forces, gravity pushing inwards and pressure pushing out, were all neatly balanced. But now we've got nuclear reactions adding large amounts of extra energy. So what happens next? Two things, actually. First, a single helium atom takes up less space than four hydrogens. So that means there's now a little bit more space to go around. With more space to move, the molecules don't hit quite as hard or as often, so the pressure drops slightly. Less pressure means that gravity starts to gain ground and the core collapses slightly, contracting tighter until all that free space is gone again. But conversely, all those photons being created by the nuclear reactions drive the temperature up. They drive it up a lot. And higher temperature means a higher average speed for all those protons bouncing around, which means more pressure. More pressure means that collisions start happening more often. More collisions means more reactions, which means more heat, and round we go. But extra pressure also means that the core can now push back harder against gravity than it could before, so that it expands, relieving pressure, causing temperature to drop. And while all this instability goes on, outside gas is still falling in, crushing down ever harder and tighter than before, and adding to the heat and pressure in the core, fueling more and more nuclear reactions. Once again, we are at a place where something has got to give. Now, there's not much more that can happen in the core. At least not until the temperature goes all the way up to something like 100 million kelvins. That's when things are hot enough for the helium to start fusing. But right now, it just cannot happen. You see, all that heat, all those photons, they're enough that they're starting to escape. The core is hot enough, still at about 10 or 15 million kelvins, that the gas closest to it, that hot, thick, compressed stuff that's not quite there yet to begin fusion, is also heating up. It's also super hot. It's also a plasma in which all those molecules are smashed apart into a seething sea of loose protons and electrons, but it's not dense enough for any of those protons to ever collide directly. So you'd think it still behaves like a simple ideal gas, balancing pressure against gravity, but it doesn't. It's being heated up from beneath. That hot nuclear core is right there touching it, raising its temperature so that its pressure also climbs way up. Not enough to fuse hydrogen atoms together, but enough to stop shrinking and stop falling inwards. These outer regions form into various layers, depending on just how big the star gets, but it's all super hot gas and plasma, and all that hot churning plasma generates powerful magnetic fields. The magnetic field, twisting and churning, interacts with the charged particles that created it, and the result is a mess, described by the horribly complicated branch of physics called magnetohydrodynamics. I'm not even going to try and explain what that's all about, except to say that you have the gas laws that we spent so much time talking about interacting with gravity to create convection currents. You know, the whole hot air rises, cold air falls idea. And that alone is enough to make some really complicated, funky, swirling currents. And since it's all so hot, it's made from charged particles, and when charged particles move, you get magnetic fields. So all this churning, moving, charged fluid creates churning, moving, changing magnetic fields. And changing magnetic fields make charged particles move. So this already complicated system then complicates itself further, and the result is it's a mess. It's probably the hardest, most difficult branch of science to pick apart, although I'm sure as I say this that there are biologists out there who are angrily clearing their throats while writing strongly worded letters to explain exactly how hard their specific subfield is. So let me apologize in advance, because I don't want to fight, and I don't want to make out that other types of scientists are not as smart or hardworking or anything like that. My point is just that it's really, really, really hard to properly model what goes on in the roiling, seething body of a star between its core and its surface. What we do know, however, is that all that stuff is probably responsible for what we actually observe over and over again, which is that a combination of radiation pressure from photons and an actual physical wind of high-energy, high-velocity charged subatomic particles works to blow away the gas and dust that were on their way to fall into the star. When we look at stellar nurseries, huge clouds of gas and dust, we see young hot stars, huge clouds of gas and dust like what I spent so much time talking about. If we look inside them with infrared telescopes that can see through the dust, we see young hot stars sitting in the middle of big bubbles inside the clouds. They are hot and they're energetic and they're blowing away their cocoons, and over time that original huge dust cloud that fed them and grew them from just little clumps of stuff into hot nuclear furnaces, it gets blown away until what was once a vast diffuse cloud hundreds of light years across is now a cluster of hot young stars. They all formed in the same cloud at roughly, very roughly, at the same time, and now they're all loosely connected to each other gravitationally, spread out over an area that used to be a gas cloud. They're all pretty much made from the same stuff, the same proportions of hydrogen, helium, and whatever other trace gases might have been around, and the same types of dust, because they all came from the same cloud. But they're not all the same size. Some are truly titanic in size, larger than our entire inner solar system, while most are much smaller. Some got fed a lot of gas, the rest, not so much. But they're all stars, and they're all new, and they're all hot and energetic, and they all have their futures mapped out ahead of them. Most will stabilize and then calmly burn for billions of years until they run out of fuel and go through another billion or so as red giants burning helium, but the largest of all will eventually detonate as supernovae. But before that can happen, a whole heap of interesting things have to happen first. And we'll be looking at that next episode. So, thank you for listening, and I hope you found this interesting and that you learned something new. If you have any comments, if you enjoyed this, or if you spotted an error that needs correcting, please reach out to me and tell me about it. You can mail me directly at podcast@urban-astronomer.com, or you can tweet me or leave a message on my Facebook page. My Twitter handle is @uastronomer, and my Facebook page is facebook.com/urbanastronomer. One word, no spaces or dashes or anything. If you can't find me, you can use the direct links on my website at www.urban-astronomer.com. You can also find subscribe links for the podcast if you're listening to this through an aggregator or on 365 Days of Astronomy. If you enjoy the show and know anybody who would also like it, you can help them find it by sharing a link to the website with them, or just tell them to search for Urban Astronomer Podcast on iTunes or Stitcher or any other directory. We are listed almost everywhere, but if you can't find us on your favorite directory, send me a note. I'll take care of it. Let's see what's next. Oh yeah, would you like to be a guest on the show? I am looking for guests and interviewees, so if you've ever wanted to break into podcasting, here is your chance. I am looking for basically anybody who has any connection to South African astronomy. Have a look at our previous guest list. We've got amateurs who love looking at the stars and who live in South Africa. We have spoken to Cassini mission scientists who discovered fascinating features of Saturn and its moons, who also happen to have been born here. We've had astronomy lecturers, a science journalist who enjoys looking at the stars, engineers who've worked on telescope control systems, and more. It doesn't matter how tenuous you think the connection is, if you have a passion for the subject and you want to share it with the world, send me an email to podcast@urban-astronomer.com and we'll see what we can arrange. One important detail though, as you look through the previous guest list, you might have noticed there's a certain demographic trend. If you're young, if you are not a white man, and you're wondering why there are so few people who look or sound like you, then I'm especially interested in hearing from you. I want to encourage young men and women in this country to follow their interest in astronomy, and that means showing examples of how other people have done that, or giving role models that you can aspire to. And given that white men like myself are a small minority in South Africa, it really doesn't make sense that they make up such a majority of my guests. And look, I'm not saying I don't want white men. You guys dominate my guest list. Obviously, I have no problem with you. I am you. But I want to talk to other people too. Yes. What I'm trying to say is, if you'd like to be on the show, but you don't want to be the only black guy in the room or the only woman in the room or whatever, well, I totally get that. But I would love to have you on anyway. And if you do, you make it easier for the next person and we can start to grow into something just a little bit more representative of the country that I'm trying to speak to. Finally, I just had a brilliant idea for a new project. You see, every now and then, I dip my toe into the turgid sea of flat earth believers. I've done a few podcast episodes, some blogs, and an awful lot of social media posts about the subject, and I tend to fall back to offering simple experiments that anybody can try at home to prove for themselves, one way or another, whether or not the earth is truly a globe. And then I moan about how nobody ever tries these experiments because they're lazy and prefer to get all the information from random dodgy YouTube videos with authentically shaky handheld cameras and cheap animations. But what I just realized is that I've never tried to perform these experiments myself, so I'm going to do it. Now, these need to be on video, and I've never done video before, apart from a few time lapses of clouds and stars, so this is not going to happen tomorrow. I'm going to have to figure out what to actually do in front of the camera, how to perform the experiments in a way that makes sense to a viewer, and generally put together a workflow to get me from performing in front of the camera to having an edited, watchable video online somewhere. So if there are any vloggers or YouTubers listening who have any advice about how to go on about stuff like this, give me a shout. Yes, so I guess that's everything for this episode, so thank you for listening. Don't forget to subscribe so that you don't miss the next episode, and clear skies.